This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Within the year, McLean County will decide whether to keep its nursing home.
17 nursing homes closed in the state of Illinois last year, county nursing homes. It is a problem adjacent counties have struggled with.
But County Board Chair John McIntyre says there's division even on how to get data to make the decision. Charlie Schlinker has the interview. Hear from a lesser-known Democratic candidate for governor. GLT's Ryan Denham talks with farmer and candidate Bob Diver. And find out what the Illinois Symphony Orchestra wants you to do with your cell phone during a performance. You might be surprised. Charlie Schlinker has that interview. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's January 25th, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The McLean County Nursing Home continues to lose about $120,000 a month. The county board has agreed to study the future of the nursing home, but there's still some friction about the way to do that. GLT's Charlie Schlinker talks with the county board chair, John McIntyre, about the situation and the process to hire a consultant to study the nursing home.
I stepped forward at a stand-up committee meeting prior to our last meeting and offered to see if I couldn't organize an advisory committee of people that have experience in management, people that have hands-on experience with Medicaid, people who could take a look at our situation and provide us some guidance in lieu of spending whatever, $50,000 or whatever it would take to hire consultants to take a look at that situation. And so I'm hoping that our advisory committee will be up and running here in the next 2 weeks. We'll provide them all the information they need, financial reports, et cetera, and see what kind of options that committee can come up with and give us to consider.
Who's on the advisory committee?
Well, we have a number of people that have experience in the field, as we've discussed. I'm kind of early in giving names, but I will tell you that there are a number of names of people that have either been CEOs or directors of long-term care facilities or CFOs who have experience with Medicaid as well. I think we'll have 8 to 10 people there who will be able to do a good job at showing some expertise and taking a look at the overall picture. To answer your original questions, yes, yes, and yes. And it's you know, we're not sure what we want to do with it yet. 17 nursing homes closed in the state of Illinois last year, county nursing homes. It is a problem adjacent counties have struggled with. We'll have to examine the structure some more and see. The assisted living, advent of assisted living care in all of the long-term care facilities has continued to grow. Nursing homes are now taking a look at different provisions like private rooms more so, or semi-private at best.
And that's not something the current facility, according to Bill Wasson, the county administrator, can accommodate or is likely to be achievable even through an extensive remodel.
Absolutely, Charlie, and it's difficult. I did a walk around out there and I'm pretty familiar with the operation, having been involved with it even back in the 80s with being chairman of the health committee of the county board. At that time, it worked really well. We'd have two semi-private rooms sharing one bath. The movement now has gone away from that, and as a result, overall, statewide, the county nursing homes have to provide better facilities, but there are some options.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with McLean County Board Chair John McIntyre. Several years ago, when the widely praised Don Lee retired as administrator of the McLean County Nursing Home, there was an effort to hire Heritage Enterprises to do a study of the nursing home, similar to what was contemplated with this RFP. That came a cropper because of the potential for conflict of interest, since Heritage Enterprises is an owner of nursing homes in our local community, and an owner of various care facilities, extended care and continuum of care facilities, and there was some leeriness about that. By having a committee composed of an advisory committee composed of people in the industry, do you encounter some of the same potential conflict of interest problems?
No, I don't, because I've taken a pretty good look at that ahead of time. And if there is anybody that is involved on this committee that's involved with the operation of nursing homes, it would be people that have no involvement with Medicaid. I've talked to Steve Wanamaker, who was a well-known director and very helpful over the years.
With Heritage.
With Heritage. And Heritage has always been very helpful to the county. They even helped us with some technical assistance and donated their time. But they're large. They do have the possibility of doing some things like that, but they do have the conflict, and right now we want to take a look at what we can do with a separate standing facility and see what we can get accomplished.
So is Steve Wanamaker on this committee?
No, he's not.
Okay.
However, we're going to ask some people that are involved in the business to be resource people and maybe appear before the advisory committee just to provide information and some experience as well.
Some county board members have told me privately that they view the advisory committee and the RFP as a both and. You're talking about in lieu of. Is that going to create some political discussions with you?
Yes, it will, internally with my board. But I do have an agreement with the board to allow me to step forward and form this advisory committee and see what advice we can get first.
Why not do both and?
Well, we might. We might, and that might be a situation where we'll come down to it. I think there's two elements of our board. That one was to wanting to advocate closing the nursing home immediately or within 2 months. I didn't agree with that. I think we really need to take an objective look at the whole situation. And I think that some of the same people also didn't want to spend money for consultants. They felt that they voiced that they thought that the members of our county board and our committees had enough ability to examine the operation of our nursing home and make a decision. I didn't agree, and I feel we needed some outside expertise and advice on doing this.
So you're trying to get a middle ground.
Yes.
Can you identify a majority of the strands of thought, if there is a majority yet?
It's my job always to try to find a consensus or find a majority with the board.
So which way are they tilting? Shut down or keep open?
Both. Both. and that's true. I'd say we're fairly split. We're getting board members who philosophically want to keep the nursing home open. I share that philosophy. But I also have to be realistic, and we have to see where we are financially. The nursing home has encumbered financial losses here in the last year and a half on a regular basis.
$1.5 million a year or thereabouts?
A little under that, but close to that, yeah, I'd say. $120,000 a month maybe right now. Part of that is a slowdown in converting from private pay to Medicaid. We have some residents who, and by the way, our nursing home has been well received, and I think has been one of the best county nursing homes around. It's been a great thing for our county and our community. And so as a result, we have had private pay people there. So any stigma about a county home, you know, has never been there for years. And Don Lee had a lot to do with that back 30 years ago even. But I don't know if there's an area there that we can just make an abrupt decision right now.
John McIntyre is the chair of the McLean County Board. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. So what is your timeline then for gathering input from the advisory committee and then making a decision whether to go forward with the RFP?
I think we need to do something within the next year for sure, because we do have some reserves that we can help supplement and operate that nursing home and keep things, our financials in good shape. As you know, our county's always been very conservative, and we have planned to a certain extent. But I think something will need to be done and decided, and hopefully within the next few months we'll get a better handle on where we are. There are many options, all the way from outside billing expenses to there's a county that has an assisted living section of the nursing home, to dedicating maybe part of our nursing home to other things, to helping increase our star Medicare rating, which we have up to 3 stars now, and that helps us with referrals from the hospitals as well. There is just maybe a little lull in where we are with attendance. I'm concerned with the nursing home being able to provide services for people who can't afford nursing homes, and making sure that this county and our community is able to provide nursing home facilities. And it takes Medicaid a lot of times to do that. But we're not sure where we are. One part of this study will be to examine all the nursing homes right now, the ones that are in private pay Medicare, the ones who are gone away from Medicaid, and what availability there is for Medicaid.
The baby boom generation retirement is still ongoing, and the demographic bulge of people who will be entering nursing homes, extended care facilities, or other kinds of facilities is not on the downswing yet. So the decision to have the existential moment for the McLean County Nursing Home seems like it's a little premature. The need is still there, isn't it?
Well, I think so. I believe so. But, again, want to take an objective look, want to do a study. I think we have the right people that can help us do that study and see what the need is going to be. We're in the sandwich generation. We're trying to provide care for people, and I'm getting to that point where, everyone is going to require some care at different times. But I feel we have to provide that as a governmental body, a local governmental body, if we can do that and we can help and we can afford it, and it's something that's just not prohibitive for us to do, that I'd like to continue trying to provide that service.
McLean County Board Chair John McIntyre also says Main Street motorists won't have to put up with one-lane traffic too much longer as the jail expansion continues. He says builders are on track for an opening of the addition late in the year. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The Democratic race for governor has been dominated in the media by 3 candidates, J.B. Pritzker, Chris Kennedy, and Daniel Biss. One of the lesser-known names in the race is Bob Diber. He's the only downstate Democrat in the race. He's a former city council and county board member and now regional superintendent of schools in Madison County outside St. Louis. Diber was in central Illinois this week talking agriculture. He is a small farmer and wants to see Illinois ban a controversial herbicide. GLT's Ryan Denham has more.
Dicamba has been around for decades, but problems arose over the past couple of years as farmers began to use it to kill invasive weeds in soybean cotton fields, where specially engineered seeds had been planted to resist the herbicide. Because it can essentially evaporate after being applied, the chemical sometimes settles on neighboring fields planted with seeds that are not resistant to dicamba. So why do you want to ban it in Illinois?
Well, I think that we have a seed system program that doesn't have all the safeguard measures that's necessary at this time. and we've seen a great number of claims. 2017 was really the introduction of this seed system program to Illinois agriculture. This system had been introduced and was used more widely in Arkansas and in Missouri in years prior. Both of them issued bans on the use of dicamba in the last year. And I believe that it is a herbicide that has the potential to do really extensive crop damage as the seed system expands in the 2018 planting season.
So other states have done this. So what kind of experiences have they had?
Well, they've had detrimental experience in that, there's been court cases, extensive claims, in excess of 2,000 claims nationwide on dicamba drift. And because of just the explanation you gave, the fallout of dicamba, it's not a controlled herbicide at the time. And I know that the Illinois Department of Agriculture for 2018 has outlined some special parameters, both on the custom application of this as well as on its use. But these do not do any safeguard to the real culprit of using dicamba, and that's the drift. So as we use this on more and more acres, we're going to see more and more damage. I don't think we are ready. The technology's not there at this time, and the plant genetics of other varieties to withstand this. And we could see a growing number of claims this coming year. Also, it's important to note that last year, many farmers were ignorant as to what was going on. I believe that the farm community has became very educated, and they know what they're looking for in order to file a claim against dicamba drift this next year. We also don't know the total impact of this environmentally in regards to the drift that it may have in subdivisions, neighboring farm fields, are in communities in general of killing other vegetations, which could be very costly and dangerous.
Now, does this run the risk of putting Illinois farmers at a competitive disadvantage, not being able to use such a popular product?
I don't know its total popularity, but I wouldn't not say no. I mean, there's other viable options that have always been there. There's the Liberty Link system. There's the glyphosate and the Roundup Ready 2 bean was very popular prior to the introduction of dicamba. I mean, it was the bean to grow. And there's still, premium for growing non-GMO soybeans. So I personally would like to see more research done to up the genetics on the yield potential in non-GMO beans.
Monsanto, which makes dicamba, they've got a bit of a litigious reputation, I think it's safe to say. Won't they just sue over this if the state were to ban dicamba? Do you think there might be litigation that would come out of that would cost the state a lot of money to fight?
Well, I think we would follow exactly what took place in Arkansas or what took place
that
in Missouri on environmental controls of this. I don't see grounds if this is proven to be an environmental concern that a state wouldn't have the right to issue such a ban.
You're the regional superintendent of schools in Madison County in southern Illinois, but you're also a small-time farmer yourself. What do you farm?
We farm soybeans and corn and some wheat on a small-scale measure. We maintain our family farm, which I farm 120 acres, and I have another 40 acres that I lease out, and then we have another farm that we lease out as well. So, I've seen it firsthand, and I've seen it on neighboring fields, and so I'm personally astute of this. This isn't a personal thing that I have in doing this, but it's a concern of producers, likewise. And there's also custom applicators that don't want to get involved in the program because they don't want the liability as well.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm in studio with Bob Diber, a Democratic candidate for governor in the March 20th primary. Bob, let's pivot to some of the other issues in the race for governor. You aren't the highest profile name in the race on the Democratic side. Some listeners may have heard you on our air back in April when you were on GLT. As you introduce yourself to Democratic voters, what do you say that about yourself that sets you apart from some of the other Democrats in the field?
Well, I will tell you this. I'm the true middle-class progressive Democrat in the race. I'm the only Democrat in the race outside of Cook County, the first in 20 years to run from southern Illinois, someone with a background in agriculture that understands Illinois' biggest business. I've been a public educator for 38 years, more experience in government than all the other candidates put together. I have 20 years of governmental experience, having served at a city council. I've been a township supervisor, served on a county board, been a countywide elected official, served the state of Illinois statewide capacity as president of the regional superintendents from 2010 to 12. I have the experience to go to Springfield and bring dignity to the office of the governor and to try to help Illinois get on sound financial ground.
What are some of the key issues you're pushing in the race?
Well, I think first and foremost is looking at the fact that we have to pay our bills in Illinois because it's the right thing to do. So this $9 to $11 billion of unpaid bills today need to be paid down. We need to develop a sound, manageable budget, put our debt interest into this budget with a payment of the principal each year, and get Illinois sound. And secondly, we need to revise our tax system in the state of Illinois. I've laid out a model to begin a progressive income tax system in the state in which lower-income working people would pay less and millionaires would pay more, and I've laid that scale out of 1 to 6%. So that's a big issue, and I'm for fully funding education in the state. I'm for moving back to fund higher education at a 2012 level before the drastic cuts were made that affected institutions like Illinois State, Eastern, Western, Southern, Northern, and helping to rejuvenate our state university system as well as all of our public schools.
Well, the things you're describing, these are big things, tough things that haven't been able to have been accomplished before. What can you tell our listeners about your skills as a political negotiator to get these things done? We've seen governors on the Democratic side who were outmaneuvered politically by the House Speaker or others. What are your political skills, and how would you deploy them to accomplish some of these big things you're talking about?
Well, first and foremost, you got to be serious about getting the job done, which I am. I'm not running for governor for this to be a hobby. This wasn't just something I'm doing because possibly I was bored doing what I was doing. I'm doing this because as an elected official and because of being an educator, I see the seriousness of what's happened. And we have got to do better as a state. We have to do better in governing. And so, you know, how do you deal with the political wherewithal of this is that I believe you need to go in collectively, be willing to collaborate and compromise with representatives that are on both sides of the aisle, bring to their attention the seriousness of what we've got to do and have a plan that's acceptable to them and to their constituents, that's realistic, that I think that they see merit in, that they could go back to their constituents and say, well, I'm supporting Governor Diver because this is a practical solution to these problems.
So Democratic primary voters, they're going to be thinking about their preferred candidate, first of all, who do they like the most and what that person has to say. But I think they're also going to be thinking about which of these candidates has the best opportunity and chance of actually beating either incumbent Governor Bruce Rauner or his primary challenger, Jeannie Ives. What would you tell Democratic voters who are wondering, okay, I like what Bob Diver has to say, can he win?
Well, I think Bob Diver brings the greatest drastic difference to the current governor in that, what Governor Rauner stood for in the turnaround agenda is about opposite as to what I stand for. It's knowing that I'm a very pro-labor person. I support the rights of working men and women to collectively bargain. I support project labor agreements. I support the prevailing wage. Those were top things that Governor Rauner looked at doing away with because he said he would make Illinois more business friendly if he could do that. I've in all the work that I've done with business growth and development in Madison County, never once has one of those topics been on the table. Okay, so that's number one. The other thing is Bob Diver's a middle class guy. He's worked and paid his taxes his entire life. I'm not affluent, I'm not wealthy, I'm no different than any other everyday person. And that's a drastic difference to our current governor. You know, we have to make a decision in the state whether we want billionaires to govern us. And I believe that the best thing that could happen for all of Illinois, from Chicago to Cairo, is if an everyday working class person, as myself, became the next governor that really understands how everyday people work and live.
You're known for being the only downstate Democrat in the race here. What are some specific things that you would do if elected governor to kind of heal that downstate versus Chicago divide that so many politicians before you have tried to worsen or at least play off of over the last few years?
Well, I think that there are issues that downstate people are facing the same as people in Chicago. Okay, we all want good public schools. So that's something we have to work on collectively. We all want safe neighborhoods. We have crime throughout the state. We have it in my county. They have it in Cook County. And we all want good-paying jobs. So how we go about bringing that together is why I've said I think there's more in this state that unites us than divides us. And we've got to talk about the goodness that the state has collectively, not pitting one part of the state against the other, saying that this part is getting the resources, that's why you're starving in this part of the state. And we have to put forth true state efforts in Illinois to help different geographical regions recover from economic depression. And in deep southern Illinois and in parts of central Illinois in the rural areas, that's how people feel. They feel that they're the forgotten. They are the forgotten Illinois. That's one of the reasons that I'm running. And if nothing else comes from my candidacy, is that I've advocated that message that there is a whole state here. There's not just one county. And this state shouldn't be ruled by one county.
That's Bob Diber, Democratic candidate for governor in the March 20th primary. Thanks for joining us in studio today, Bob.
Thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed it.
I'm Ryan Denham.
Other Democrats running for Illinois governor include J.B. Pritzker, Chris Kennedy, Daniel Biss, T.O. Hardiman, and Robert Marshall. The primary is March 20th. You can find more election news on GLT's new Facebook group. Just search Election 28 in McLean County. You're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. Sound Ideas, I'm Mike McCurdy. You might think a piece of classical music composed about a symposium on different philosophers would not be terribly romantic. You'd be wrong. The Illinois Symphony Orchestra will demonstrate that tomorrow evening with a performance of Leonard Bernstein's Serenade for Orchestra. In this conversation with GLT's Charlie Schlenker, ISO Music Director Ken Lamb says the work shows the two sides of Bernstein's personality, the deeply emotive and the heady man of ideas.
I think Bernstein, has always been, and he said so himself, you know, a composer of theater. And he takes a lot of inspiration from words. You have to look at, you know, of course, the serenade after the symposium, The Age of Anxiety, you know, after Auden's poem, and all his theater work. So he gets inspired by words. A lot of times he said, well, these are just feelings that he has to the work. Sometimes you can't help but notice even a dramatic progression, you know, through what the text says. And I think Bernstein, I mean, that's in many ways, that's what all great artists are. They both have the Apollonian and the Dionysian. You know, you have to have kind of both sides.
Take us through the progression of those feelings in this five-movement concerto form serenade, would you?
Well, first of all, the serenade, it's his violin concerto in disguise. It's a very, very difficult violin concerto written for Isaac Stern. And so when you look at the different movements, you know, these are, I think, seven philosophers in the symposium talking about, you know, really celebrating love and what love is and what love means. And Bernstein, the way he wrote it was to sort of really capture the spirit of the speeches. You have to depict the doctor. It's a very, very fast movement with hiccups. The way he described it was that he, because it's the same subject matter, love, so you hear this motif at the very beginning, and the whole piece is really a transformation, a variation of this motif, so representing different aspects of love. And you can hear this very clearly. Sometimes this motif is in the foreground as a melody, sometimes it is in the background as an accompaniment. And sometimes it is augmented and varied. So I think this is a way of using musical forms to represent what he thought of the text.
There are a couple of parallels between the Serenade and the Mahler First Symphony, the Titan Symphony. Both Mahler and Bernstein, of course, are Titans, and both works appear to have been inspired by words. In Mahler's case, it was a book called Titan by a guy named Jean-Paul. How did that work manifest itself in Mahler's music?
If you look at music written the time of Mahler, it really started with Beethoven, you know, before music was written for perhaps, you know, nobility and princes for their entertainment. Composers were like, you know, basically court entertainers. Since Beethoven's time, composers wrote music for themselves, to express themselves. And Mahler really took it to the extreme. If you look at this first symphony, the Titan, you know, who's the hero in this symphony? It's Mahler himself. So it, in many ways, I think, yes, I mean, he was inspired by the book, but he was really writing about himself. It was really about his struggles, his relationship with nature, and it's all about him. And that's kind of what romanticism is, the elevation of the individual.
The work came at a time when program music was really just coming into vogue, and he started it with the title Titan, and then he said, you know what, I'm going to yank the title. I don't like the idea of a program music. We're just going to try and view the work as it is. Does that detract from its romantic spirit or enhance it, or how should we reflect on that choice?
Program music has been around for a long time, and in particular, in symphonic music, really started with Berlioz, and then the whole school, you know, going that list, and Wagner and so on. I think what Mahler was trying to say is that, of course, there is a dramatic narrative to the music, but he doesn't want people to limit it to like, okay, well, this measure is about birds, or this measure is about love or struggle. I think in many ways you look at the notes and you listen to music and you can apply it to your own experiences. And because when we live in the 21st century, these notes may mean something different than what it meant in the 19th century. I think there's a timelessness to Mahler's music that shouldn't be restricted by, you know, a certain image. But of course, you know, he was inspired by these images.
Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Ken Lamb, the music director of the Illinois Symphony Orchestra, in advance of Friday evening's concert at the BCPA. This is the first concert where people will be able to access an app at the same time. It's called NQ. There is commentary that happens as the concert rolls along. This tends to go against the high church kind of sensibility of becoming wrapped in the music. What does it add and what does it detract, depending on where you sit in that spectrum?
That's actually a very interesting question, especially all because of the pieces that we're playing. As we all know, music, I think I mentioned earlier, was really before Beethoven and Mahler's time, was written to entertain people. So, you know, in an opera house, you know, people would be eating, you know, playing cards and engaging in conversation, throwing stuff onto the stage. If they like something, they will clap, and if they don't like something, they'll boo. It's very, very common until really the time of Beethoven and Mahler. And Mahler famously, when he was director of the Vienna State Opera, I mean, he was the guy who turned round to the audience, stared them down until they were absolutely quiet before he would start the downbeat to his concert. You know, this is a tenet of Romanticism, which means I have something so important to say to you that you better be quiet. While I can completely see the music of Mahler demands that kind of attention, it might be different if you're playing a Rossini overture. And I think the music itself, and that's the magic of music, the music itself tells us what kind of atmosphere it demands.
What will people get from this app during the Bernstein?
It's a sort of running commentary on, you know, okay, you're going to be hearing a really fast section now, or, you know, with lots of percussion, and this is the, you know, the recapitulation, or some sort of more detailed running commentary of what is actually in the music. I mean, this is the climax of the movement. You know, for musical nerds like myself, you know, I might have appreciated something like that when I was young. When I go to the concert, you know, of course, I would read the program notes and really try and follow the music, especially if it's something that I'm not familiar with. I went to these concerts because I want to learn something. Now, there are times also when I go to a concert, I just want to relax and let the music does its work for me. So I think this gives us a chance.
Ken Lamb is the music director of the Illinois Symphony Orchestra. He's speaking with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. The orchestra performs works by Mahler and Bernstein tomorrow evening at the BCPA. You can discover more local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois in the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. You're listening to Leonard Bernstein conduct the Vienna Philharmonic in Mahler's First Symphony. If one phrase emerged in 2016, it was, elections matter. Be an informed voter and submit your questions for our 13th District Democratic Congressional Candidate Forum, February 6th at the Normal Theater. Meet the five candidates hoping to unseat Rodney Davis. Get up to speed on their positions and see how they handle your questions. Submit them at our website and then attend the forum at 6 p.m. at the Normal Theater February 6th or listen live or online at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from the BCPA, presenting Push Physical Theater's adaptation of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Saturday, February 3rd. Combining acrobatic motion theater and traditional dialogue, it's an innovative take on one of literature's most famous villains. Contains mature content. Tickets at artsbelieving.org. This is GLT.
That's music from country folk rocker James McMurtry's classic song, Leveland. The critically acclaimed songwriter says the mood of the country forced his hand to write from a more political point of view. It's a mood he picked up on more than a decade ago. McMurtry returns to the Twin Cities for a show at the Castle Theater in downtown Bloomington tomorrow night. In this encore interview, GLT's John Norton talks with McMurtry about his songwriting.
Many of your songs focus on both the good and the bad of rural life, and sometimes it can be in the same song. For example, Out Here in the Middle. What draws you to focus on the rural? What draws you to focus on people on the edges of society or outside the big city?
Well, I grew up mostly in rural Northern Virginia, and most of my extended family, cousins and uncles, they all live in rural Texas. So got a little bit of experience with it. And I don't know, but I do try to write the dark side because I get sick of hearing what have they done with the old home place over and over again. Because I know what they did with the old home place, you know. Grandpa got senile, your evil Aunt Frances got power of attorney and sold it out from under everybody. That's what happens in the real country.
We got a justification for wealth and greed. Amber waves of green and bathtub speed. Now we even got Starbucks. What else you need? Out here in the middle, where the center's on the right.
Well, you really get inside the characters of your songs, at times brilliantly. What struck me on a number of songs is sometimes how often that they know their loved one isn't perfect, or maybe not even the right person for them, but they realize that's a choice they've made and they're sticking with it.
Yeah, sometimes.
Yeah, I think it's a brilliant observation.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I don't know. I hadn't really thought about that too much either. I write from the point of view of a character. I generally get I get a couple lines in a melody, and I think, who said that? And I try to envision the character, and then I write the song from that character's point of view. And that's how I get my songs written. And a lot of times the story will change for the sake of rhyme and meter.
Sure.
Because the song still has to be sung. And you can write the best story you want, put to verse, but if it doesn't sing, it's not a song. So, you know, lots of things come into play there. Voice training. Voice coaches will teach you what consonants work and what vowels work with one another. And, that bleeds into the songwriting eventually.
Well, you're certainly an observer. Would you agree with that characterization?
Yeah. I think it probably came easy. My father and I left Texas when I was 7 years old, and we always kind of felt a little bit on the outside of things. But it made it easier to see the inside because, you know, the people that had been in one place all their life, it seems that, you know, there were things around them that they just didn't notice anymore. Because it was normal to them, but, you know, to us being from somewhere else, you know, perceptions of distance. We lived out in about 50 miles out of D.C. at a time when nobody commuted that far into D.C. There wasn't an infrastructure. There were no trains. The highway was 2-lane from the beltway out. But my dad didn't think anything of that. He was from Texas where 100 miles is nothing.
From your latest album, Complicated Game, the song These Things I've Come to Know, who is that?
Well, that's a fictional character just like everybody else in my songs.
Okay. Well, could you talk a little bit about that song? That really grabbed me.
I don't remember. I was messing around in that drop D tuning that I usually use. And now that character is similar to, you know, several others in my songs, which are, there may be snatches of reality, but my son explained one time, I heard him talking to somebody about songwriting, and he said, you know, you can't write a song about one woman. You got to have about five of them to make a composite. That's pretty much true.
She'll spend a dollar quick as a dime. She goes commando most all of the time. And she writes a fine prose, I'd have to say, finer than mine. These things I've come to know. These things I've come to know.
When you wrote the song, We Can't Make It Here Anymore, you caught some flack for that. Was that the first time you wrote an overtly political song, or at least put it on record?
Well, there was Safe Side back on my second record, which is kind of more social commentary than political. But, yeah, I caught some flack for that song, but that also turned a corner for me. I got into a lot bigger venues after that song came out because a lot of people identified with it.
Well, and it's a very angry song as well. You know,
there's a lot of angry people out there, if you hadn't noticed. Just go to a Trump rally.
Yeah, I've been to one. It was scary.
It's been scary for years, and I don't know why all this anger is surprising anyone. You know, Tim McVeigh blew the side off a building in Oklahoma City long before 9/11. That anger was there. I'm not sure why. I think it's perception more than anything. You know, we got a lot of people that think they're broke, but they're driving around in cars and they got food to eat and nobody's shooting at them. You know, there's whole different perceptions of poverty in other places.
Some have maxed out all their credit cards. Some are working two jobs and living in cars. Minimum wage won't pay for a roof, won't pay for a drink. If you gotta have proof, just try it yourself, Mr. CEO. See how far 5:15 an hour will go. Take a part-time job at one of your stores. I bet you can't make it here.
I mentioned you got some flack, but you also, you know, you get reviewed on a regular basis. You're an artist. You're a musician. Do you end up reading your reviews?
Some of them. It's mostly ill-advised because you start second-guessing everything.
When you do need to turn to somebody on the artistic side, do you just rely on yourself, or do you have someone you do turn to, someone you trust?
To tell me if it's okay? No. Basically, if I can sing a song without cringing, then it's finished.
Yeah, so you know it right away.
Yeah, you can feel it when it's working. Sometimes you can take it out and play it for people. And it's interesting. I mean, some of the songs that I like that I've written, for example, there's one on one of the Sugar Hill records. There's one called Racing to the Red Light. And it's sort of the spot that artists get in this country where, you know, where art is not particularly respected. And I guess it's respected, but it's not considered essential like it is in some countries. So we try to teach our kids not to be artists. We admire those that are, but, you know, you want your kid to finish school and be a lawyer or something. You know, any kind of artistic pursuit with a lot of people is not considered to be a real job. And so I addressed that in Racing to the Red Light, and, that's a pretty rocking little tune. I go out and sing it, and it was just, I just draw a total blank, no matter how full the room was. I finally quit doing it. You know, I do it at sound check every now and then.
Well, I'm going to ask you about another song from the Complicated Game album. And to me, Copper Canteen, it's brilliant in that it encapsulates an entire relationship in a 4.5-minute song, and yet it still captures a snapshot of a single day at the same time. I just think that's brilliant.
Yeah, I got lucky with that one, too. It's one of those where, you know, you know it's going to work after the first line. Those are rare.
Honey, don't you be yelling at me when I'm cleaning my gun. I'll wash the blood off the tailgate when deer season's done. We got one more weekend to go, and I'd like to kill one more doe.
You seem to be nostalgic in your writing about the old days, but at the same time, getting people to remember, you know, those old days were difficult times.
Well, it's not so much that I pine for them, but I don't want the details to be completely forgotten. So I'll put details in my songs that I didn't even experience. You know, there was Red Dress. There's a line. People have asked me over and over again, what does it mean, you know, out the back and down the alley going to get your bucket spiked?
Well, you know, they can have various meanings, but the term comes from Prohibition, when some bars were selling near beer, 3.2 alcohol, and there was usually a bootlegger shack somewhere close by, so you carried your bucket of beer out the back and over to the bootlegger shack and got it spiked with grain alcohol. That was getting your bucket spiked.
Okay.
There are other connotations you can throw into that, but, you know, that's just a term that I heard and thought, well, I'll hang on to that one just to maybe live a while longer.
Backing down the alley, going to get your bucket spiked. Come back when you think you need me. Come back anytime you like. Where'd you get that red dress?
We talked about being an artist. What do you consider your masterpiece? Do you have one or two?
No, I don't think I do.
I mean, a lot of people might say Choctaw Bingo or Leveland or something like that.
Well, the song we enjoy playing most, I think, is Restless.
How come?
Something about there's a lift to it. There's a melodic lift, or, you know, there's just something about the way the chorus is lifted that we always get into. I don't know what it is, and it's a collective thing. It's not just me. It's a band thing. And it doesn't work as well in solo performance, though. Well, I mean, it works well, but it doesn't have that band energy.
James McMurtry, thank you for taking time to talk to us a little bit about your songwriting, about your music.
All right. Thank you. Y'all have a good day.
Country folk rocker James McMurtry speaking with GLT's John Norton. McMurtry says his band plays the Castle Theater in downtown Bloomington Friday night. Discover more music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois in the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app.
And the conversation slows to a stop, and I might as well be out alone.
Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Find John Norton's interview and all of the other individual stories and interviews today from Ryan Denham and Charlie Schlenker on our website, WGLT.org. We want your feedback. We want to know what you think of this show and what you hear on it. Post your comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. Email us at news@WGLT.org or tweet, use the hashtag Sound Ideas. I'm at Mike McCurdy. We're all at WGLT News. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.